Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to our very special Thanksgiving edition of Catholic Answers Live. We are not live today because we thought we'd stay home and clean the dishes for our wives after we eat the turkey. We thought that was more important, but we do have a very, very special lineup for you. Next hour, Jimmy Akin will be here for an open forum of an internet variety. All the questions come from the internet for Jimmy. This hour, we're going to kind of stick with part of the theme of Thanksgiving. You're probably familiar, as almost every American is, with the story of the Pilgrims and the first Thanksgiving with the Indians and all that. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's entirely a fable, but it's the truth is much wider than that, and that's what we want to explore today, the wider truth in which these things happened, and then the consequences down through the centuries. And because this is Catholic Answers, particularly how American religion and the Catholic faith, or people who are bound to the American religion and people of the Catholic faith have interacted, what the consequences of that has been, and where we are today. To do that with us is our president, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers. Thanks very much for being with us this Thanksgiving, Chris.
Si, thank you. And I'm not doing any dishes.
Oh, you're not?
No.
Do you have boys for that?
Well, I did. I mean, I do, but they're not.
Do you have dogs for that?
They would. They actually would clean the dishes.
Yeah, they would.
We're going over to Jackie's sister and brother-in-law.
Oh, that's the way to do that.
I know. I just have to show up with a pie and a few bottles of wine.
Nice. And you are good at picking the wine. What pairs with turkey? Red or white?
Red, of course.
Oh, yeah. Of course. See, you say of course. That means I'm an idiot for asking
no,
a question.
No, listen, Si, red wine goes with everything.
Oh, that's good to know.
It goes with your Fruit Loops in the morning.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. I didn't want you to tell anybody about my Fruit Loops, but okay. now that we've revealed that.
Or Captain Crunch or Apple Jacks.
Okay, so if we could start with the Pilgrims. They're the very—
They did not have Fruit Loops.
They did not. No, they would have thanked God for some Fruit Loops if they'd had them at some point.
They did have wine, actually, quite a bit on the Mayflower.
Was that a sanitary thing?
Like that? Yeah, well, beer especially, of course, because beer doesn't go bad.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, that's not altogether true. But anyway, water can.
Yeah.
Can become, infected? I don't know what
the
word is. But
fetid.
Yeah, the alcohol in beer preserves it, and so it's safe to drink. And also, beer is a guard against scurvy.
I didn't know that. Does it have vitamin C in it? Or is it just—
I don't know exactly what it is, and I can't even tell you exactly what scurvy is.
So
scurvy is a vitamin C deficiency, so sure, I suppose, yeah. But we see scurvy present on the Mayflower when the beer runs out.
Well, here's a question.
I know we're jumping ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I was just trying to segue from—
Especially as Catholics, we need to talk a little bit about
alcohol.
I mean, alcohol is one of the great fuels of history. I mean, so—
As I tell my boys, Jesus' first public miracle was making wine after people had been drinking for a while.
Yeah.
And the apologists here at Catholic Answers have not confirmed this for me, but when you read the Cana account in the gospel, after that, where does Jesus go? He goes down to Capernaum, right? So he's going to this beach town. So you just know how the conversation went. He just met these guys.
Yeah.
And we do know there's a lot of wine left over.
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty easy to put two and two together. What happens, our Lord goes down to Capernaum with all this extra wine. I've got this friend. He's got a house down by the beach. Then— Can you imagine the conversations?
Right. And that's why he probably gets accused of being a wine bibber and a glutton later.
Well, sure.
I mean, he's not a drunkard, clearly, but he doesn't mind a good glass of wine.
No, absolutely not.
I don't know if they drank it from glasses then, but probably not, right?
Maybe no glass comes a little later.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so 14th century, 15th century.
I have a feeling I could range across all of human history with you, Chris, and I would learn things.
I'm trying to do, Si, is use up the hour before you ask me a question I don't know the answer to.
Well, I have this. But here's a question I'm fairly certain you will. The Pilgrims, here's the important thing about the Pilgrims. They are the first English to come to the New World and establish themselves here, correct?
No.
What?
That's wrong. the Jamestown settlement is 1607. Now, okay, establish themselves, if that's what you're...
Oh, okay.
If that's what you're hinging that on. But so Jamestown is 1607, and that is a disaster from the first. You've got well-to-do men and soldiers, mostly men, very few women in the Jamestown settlement. And they don't really make a good go of it. Most of the colony dies originally. They have a very difficult relationship. That's understating it. Violent relationship with the natives. So in Plymouth, the Pilgrims, they get established a little more easily than Jamestown does. But they are 1607 is Jamestown. Plymouth is 1620. So more than a decade after.
Wow, yeah.
And then, and also part of the national myth goes that the Mayflower Compact is sort of the first example of representative democracy or something. That's not entirely true. There is a vote in 1619 in Jamestown.
A year before the Pilgrims even came.
Yes, yeah. Right. So Jamestown is first. But the Pilgrims, you ask any school kid, American school kid, that's where the national myth begins.
Yep. And
it begins in England.
But part of what's helpful to the Pilgrims is smallpox, that already smallpox has come to New England. It's cleared out places for them to settle.
Yeah, so some historians are now saying plague.
Oh, plague, not smallpox.
Yeah,
okay, but disease.
Yeah, so Massachusetts is not completely empty of Native Americans.
Right.
But fewer than in parts of Virginia.
Right.
But the relationship is more harmonious. The Squanto story is largely true. They do get some...
That Squanto story, if we could, because it...
You're going to have to.
but it's... Here's this guy. He's from Massachusetts. He's... I can't remember if he's one of the Pawtucket people or what, but he gets taken by the Spanish as a slave on a fishing vessel, because the Spanish would come over, as would the French, the Huguenot French would come over and fish the North Atlantic.
Sure.
And so they were, before anybody really made the journey to settle, the fishermen were coming.
The fishermen and the beaver traders.
Yeah, right.
The pelt traders.
So yeah. Squanto gets taken as a slave to Spain. So that's the end of that story. No, but somehow he ends up in England.
Right.
Learns to speak English.
Yeah.
Comes back to Massachusetts, finds all his people dead from disease. So he joins up with another group, I think the Massasoit. And then now you have an English-speaking Indian guy who's there ready to greet the Pilgrims when they show up by miraculous turns of events.
Yeah, to greet and help them. And I used to be very skeptical of the Squanto story. Because I just tend to be skeptical of, you know, national myths, period. But it's in the main true.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, here are a people who for centuries have perfected methods of agriculture. So they know about crop rotation. I'm speaking of Europeans. And so they know about methods of crop rotation and this sort of thing. And yet they get to Massachusetts where the soil is different. They've brought seeds with them. They're not having good success. Right. And he shows them, yes, use some dead fish as fertilizer and mix it in with the soil and this sort of thing.
And all that stuff happens.
And
he introduces them to the chief, or what's called a sachem in Massachusetts. And so they make friends, and there is this kind of... I'm sure that the Indian people weren't thrilled to see settlers. I mean, one of the first things the Pilgrims did was kind of plunder storage and burial places to get corn.
Well, yes, absolutely. And so the Pilgrims show up in December,
yeah,
right?
And nice move.
They're not – well, they were – well, they, of course, we all know that the plan was to go to Virginia.
Yeah,
and
right.
But because of storms, they end up – off, what is that, Cape Cod?
On Cape Cod,
yeah,
the first land.
And so they have a hard time of it the first winter. And you're right, they are surviving on things that they had, stores that they had from the Mayflower, but also stores that the Indians had put up.
Yeah, you know? And So why, though? Why are they there? What's going on in Europe that these people would do this?
Okay, so Europe at the time, beginning of the 17th century, the monarch on the throne is James I, or what the English call James VI and the First, because he's James VI of Scotland.
Right, they love their Jameses there in Scotland.
Yes, and by the way, he was a Stuart king.
Okay.
And they were the people who, you know, bred the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
The most important event in human history, the breeding of the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
Yeah.
The only dogs able to clean your dishes for you.
So in any case, James the First and the Sixth is a relatively tolerant fellow. He's in Germany right now. Europe is being torn apart by the 30 Years' War, a horrible war of religion that ends up claiming the lives of millions. Directly or indirectly, and James is trying to avoid this kind of religious strife on the British Isles. He's trying to unite Scotland and England under one parliament, and so on one side of this, what we now call like the Via Media, right? He's got the Catholic, the remnants of Catholicism,
right?
That the Puritans are trying to do away with. So Puritans are Christians who belong to the Church of England but want to see it purified from its Catholic trappings. Paraphernalia. It's all its, you know,
smells and bells.
Sacerdotal superstitions, right, all that. Yeah. There's a particular brand of Puritan called separatists, and they think there's no hope for the Church of England. It's too Catholic, and they are we have to separate it from completely. And they're not really welcome in James's England. Most of them come from East Anglia, right? So that far eastern portion in the south of England, above London, that kind of pokes out there.
So closest to Europe.
Yeah.
They're the closest English to Europe.
Sure. Well, I don't know. You would say Dover is closest to France. But anyway, on the east side, yes. Yeah. So this is where the Puritans come from. There is a particular brand of them, separatists. They have a go of it in Holland for a while. But there are two problems with Holland. One is it's Dutch. It's not English.
Right.
And they want their kids to be English. Mm-hmm. The other is that you've got the Spanish involved in the Low Countries or the Netherlands. And so there's a concern on their part that Spanish Catholicism is going to overtake.
And it's not going to go well for them if Catholicism comes.
Not in their view.
Right.
And to be fair, going back to the late 16th century, the Spanish treatment of the Calvinists in the Low Countries ebbs and flows in terms of justice, I guess you could say.
All right. So we have these English separatists who have now gone to Holland. We have to take a break. We'll find out how they end up in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Right after this with Chris Check.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Howdy, folks. This is Jimmy Akin. Christmas is coming, and with Advent just around the bend, we want to make sure that you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources, all on sale at 20% off when you enter the promo code WINTER at checkout. We've got great new resources on Scripture, church history, the saints, my new book on Bible prophecy, and so much more. There's no better time to stock up on resources to help build your faith and the faith of those around you. Just phone 888-291-8000 or go to the online shop at Catholic.com right now to take advantage of this great Catholic sale going on now through the end of the year. Remember, enter the promo code WINTER at checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Luke 19:41, Jesus wept over the city of Jerusalem, saying, "If this day you only knew what makes for peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes." He went on to predict the dire consequences it would suffer because it would not reform. The Old Testament is filled with such examples. Actually, this is the story of the human race. Even as recent as 1917, God warned the world through Our Lady's apparitions at Fatima, Portugal, to reform. She asked that people repent of their sinful ways, or a terrible world war would take place. World War II could have been prevented. More recently, Jesus warned St. Faustina that now is the time to ask for his mercy, not later. These latter were private revelations, but they warrant our attention. The Lord deserves that we repent of our sins and honor him by the way we live. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Very special Thanksgiving Day edition with our president, Chris Flower. I looked down that says Mayflower. I said Chris Flower. Chris Jack.
I like that, though.
Yeah? Chris Checkflower is our guest. I have Mayflower on my notes because when we left, we had gotten this small English separatist community over to Holland. They don't like being among the Dutch, in part because it doesn't feel very English to them,
right.
And also in part because they do face some possible threat from Spanish on their borders. So where do they go and what do they do?
Well, they come back to England.
Okay.
And they strike a deal with, and I'm not going to remember the name of the company, I'm sorry, but one of these corporations that is making money in the colonization of the New World.
Okay.
And they're making money in a variety of ways. I mean, the Spanish come to the New – that also, by the way, Cy, the first question that you asked, you know, the Mayflowers are the first one – or excuse me, the Pilgrims are the first one here. Spanish, of course, came here with Cortez in 1517, something like that.
And isn't the oldest city in our country
Spanish,
St. Augustine?
Yeah, yeah. Or I think
St.
Augustine.
St. Augustine.
But right, and that's all Spanish. And then, of course, the French are in Canada at the time. While this story is taking place, the Mayflower story of genuine interest to Catholics is the French colonization of Canada, which includes Isaac Jogues, Jean de Brébeuf, right? The what we call the North American martyrs, or what they call the Canadian martyrs there. In fact, the colonists in Massachusetts are concerned that the French in Canada are going to come down and attack them.
Right.
But anyway, I'm getting ahead. I apologize. So they hook up with one of these companies that is colonizing the New World. They raise the money for passage. And I think there's about 40 of them, something like that. The Mayflower is a very small ship, certainly by today's standards.
Well, they started out with two ships.
There's the Speedwell.
Is
that the other one? And then it springs a leak. And there are some historians now who think that the crew deliberately
– they didn't want to go.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it is a very unpleasant crossing, at least 2 months.
Yeah.
Now – Here's what if you live, our San Diego listeners should go to the Maritime Museum and then they can see Juan Cabrillo's galleon.
Yes,
that's about 100 feet long.
Right.
So that's about the size of the Mayflower, and you've got about 100 people, 100, 102. We don't know exactly. 40 of them are pilgrims. There's about 30 crew, maybe, and then there are the people that the pilgrims called strangers who were coming for other reasons, not seeking, you know, what we say religious freedom. That's not absolutely correct. Mostly they were looking to – the pilgrims were looking to practice religious exceptionalism, actually.
So they didn't want to found a country where, hey, everybody's welcome.
No,
they wanted to found a essentially English Puritan place.
Right. That part of the myth comes much, much later, that sort of pluralist myth.
Yeah, right.
So they get to Plymouth, and the word pilgrim appears in the work of William Bradford in his history about the expedition. He draws on the letter to the Hebrews in pulling out that word, but and then there's another element of this exceptionalism that comes 10 years later, a decade later, with the settling of the Massachusetts Bay Colony under John Winthrop. And of course, he's the one he's among the leaders of Massachusetts Bay. He's the one who gives us that shining city on a hill rhetoric, which, of course, gets picked up much later, first by Kennedy and then by Ronald Reagan, but also becomes part of this national myth of American exceptionalism. And then that finds – I'm sorry. You were
no,
going to
no, no.
Question.
Go ahead,
well,
please.
And then that finds expression in a variety of ways. So Abraham Lincoln, in the middle of the war between the states, is looking for something to unify the country. The original Thanksgiving proclamation, if you even want to call it that, comes from George Washington. He says that there should be a national day, fourth Thursday in November, a national day of Thanksgiving. It's not official, if you will, under...
It's one of those kind of proclamations that you get all the time.
He encourages.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
But Lincoln does make it a national holiday, and he's trying to... It's a grab at unification during a time when the country is torn apart by the war between the states, and so he has a choice, and he picks, you know, Massachusetts over Virginia, right, over Jamestown. So he picks Plymouth.
Yeah.
He picks the Massachusetts Bay Colony over Jamestown. So and this is an obvious selection of North over South.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, it is.
Yeah. Right. Why you in the middle of a civil war, you're not going to say, and the founding of this beautiful country
begins at Jamestown.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So that's to this day why third graders or kindergartners or both dress up as, you know, with big black hats and that sort of thing and not. Well, who knows what they were wearing in Jamestown, because we never dressed that way in third grade.
Yeah, right. So we've forgotten it.
But they did probably eat turkeys at the first. They were wild turkeys. They probably shot them. And wild turkeys were part of the diet in England, so it wouldn't have been uncommon. I'm sorry, I'm ranging.
No, not at all, actually. So, but I want to get to something, because the part of this Thanksgiving thing that really comes from Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. Part of the myth, as you say, is...
Yeah, and by the way, I just want to be clear. I don't mean myth...
Like it's pretend. It's just the way we tell the story.
I mean, all nations have their myths, and they are good things. And they're, of course, there's an element of truth in these myths.
Yeah.
And they're actually important. They are important
for the
sense of identity of who a people are.
Yeah.
And sometimes these myths are... A little contrived.
Well, part of the myth then is this kind of felicitous relationship between the Indians of Massachusetts and the Pilgrims. It may be that by Lincoln's time, the Indians have already been so badly abused and shoved out of the way that it's perfectly safe to depict it that way.
Yeah, probably by design. And there, I can't quote you chapter and verse. That would just be my gut. But the relationship, as we said, between Jamestown and the Indians was a brutal and violent one in the main.
Right.
In the Massachusetts Bay Colony and with Plymouth, the relationship was much more peaceful. However, it is true that the Pilgrims did make their military forays out and attack various Indian tribes, and the various Indian tribes that allied themselves with the Pilgrims were doing so in alliances against other Indians.
Right.
And essential to this story is an understanding of, well, we were talking about the fish trade, but also the beaver trade,
yeah,
and who's going to control that. And the Indians are part of this economic struggle as well, or struggle for economic supremacy. And the same thing's going on in Canada. And so you've got the French making alliances with Huguenots, Hurons.
Yeah, no, not Huguenots, right? Yeah.
Although there are Huguenots in Canada, in the Quebec settlement.
Huron Indians.
Yes, against the Iroquois or members of the League of the Iroquois, for example, the
Mohawk,
exactly, among them, the Algonquin. So the same story. The same kind of allegiance with Indians is taking place. But you are correct. From this myth or this self-understanding of American exceptionalism...
Got to take a break. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Author and blogger Shane Kapler says, "The apostasy that wasn't is sure to be one of the best written histories you'll ever encounter." Rod Bennett is an astonishingly talented writer, and he successfully brings to life the most tumultuous period in church history. Order your copy of The Apostasy That Wasn't today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hello, this is Bishop Jeffrey Monfort, and Bishop of the Diocese of Steubenville. Make sure you keep it on Catholic Answers Live. God bless you.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In. Blessed and happy Thanksgiving to you. Gratitude. We all talk about it. It's like a muscle. You got to practice. You got to work it. You got to look around you. You got to see all the things you can be grateful for. And there's a lot that we don't even notice. Breathing, walking, thinking, love. Gratitude is a muscle. You got to work it, and you got to get better at it.
Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terrence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world, but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our On Fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, very special Thanksgiving Day edition of the show, and I'm enjoying talking with Chris Check, our president, so much that I just forgot to go to the break. It just went straight into the commercial. Sorry about that, Chris.
Sigh, you're being generous. What you should say is, Chris, you're too long-winded. You need to be quiet when you hear the music.
I'm no fool, Chris. I'm not going to talk to you that way.
So we're talking about we got up to some conversation about the relations between Europeans and the Indians here, and how there is a bit of whitewashing that goes on. I don't know if whitewashing is the right word, if that has some racist implication. Excuse me, but I never know today.
No, you have to be very careful which words you're allowed to say.
Any color, it words. But you do get this kind of very nice picture, which is not a lie. There was great cooperation, especially the second year of the Pilgrims in Massachusetts and all that. But it does certainly leave out what happened to the native people of North America in large part. And so it's a little bit of a gloss. It's not a lie, but it's a little bit of a gloss on history. But this is not that is to say, the native people of the Americas were not treated the same way by all the Europeans. And there's something to be said in favor of the Spanish and against the English.
Yeah, and in favor of the French as well. It is true that when Cortez comes to Mexico, he does lead an expedition in which he vanquishes the Aztec Empire, yeah. Or they wouldn't have called themselves Aztecs, Mexica, or Tenochca. But once he does, and yeah. By the way, he does it allied with other native tribes.
Who are being oppressed.
Yeah, yes. They welcomed Cortez. This is a part of the story you never hear. I mean, they were glad that he showed up because they were tired of being thrown off of the pyramids in
It does get tiring. Yes, it really, yes. that'll take a toll on you.
Yes. So, but Cortez's policy is convert and integrate. So, and by integrate, intermarry. So there's not, you don't see intermarrying between the between the pilgrims and the native population.
Right.
You do see it. Cortez. Cortez has an Indian lover. So, you know, their child is the first mestizo child, if that's the correct word. And
I know what you mean. But first, mixed Mexican child, yeah.
Yeah, and or Creole, or I don't know. That Spanish had a different list depending on how much blood of which you had in. But anyway, so immediately they start baptizing and they start intermarrying. The experience with the English Protestants in the United States is summed up in this expression we all learned in eighth grade or ninth grade history called manifest destiny, which is a nice way of saying, you know, keep pushing the brown people towards the Pacific Ocean. And manifest destiny was the justification that white Protestant colonizers of first the Eastern Seaboard and then the West used to justify the treatment of the native population. This is a quote from Herman Melville in 1850 that I think encapsulates this. He says, "Americans are the peculiar chosen people, the Israel of our time. We bear the ark of the liberties to the world. God has predestined mankind, expects great things from our race and great things we feel in our souls. Long enough have we been skeptics with regard to ourselves and doubted whether indeed the political Messiah had come. Wow. But he has come in us."
Whoa!
So that's Melville. Now, whether that's Melville or the voice of one of his characters, I can't say for sure, but it does represent. And then in the Congressional Record, we see Senator John Dix from New York puts manifest destiny in religious terms. He says, "It is the behest of providence that idleness and ignorance and barbarism shall give way to industry and knowledge and civilization." So who's he talking about? Idleness, ignorance, and barbarism? The native people. And you actually even see this exact same rhetoric going back to Bradford in the Plymouth colony. He talks about the uncivil savages, right? Now, actually, I'm not put off by that word because they were, you know, savages. But nonetheless, it is this idea that this land what is for us. And so there is a contrast there between the Spanish expedition, the horrors of which we hear so much about.
Yes.
Right. And also France in Canada, which is not as successful as Spain and Mexico. And what happens here in the United States.
Right. And it's
bad.
And it just goes on and on, decade after decade, even century after century. Whereas in Mexico, it settled very quickly.
Well, it's the difference between a Protestant country and a Catholic one.
Yeah.
And that's something that Catholics need to understand. Catholics really have an uneasy relationship with the United States. We have to be honest about that.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I want to mention one part of American literary history that many people may not remember, but there's a thing called colonial captivity stories. And these are lurid tales, mostly of women, but sometimes men, who got captured by the essentially satanic Indians and then got free. And these were these are like the superhero stories of the colonial period. But you can see the underlying message of them is there's tremendous danger from these satanic creatures that are on the outskirts of our towns, and it's kind of sexual danger. But it speaks a great deal to the English mentality about not all English were cruel or evil, or, you know, but there is a mentality about the Indian people that is much, much more other to them than, say, a Mexican Indian is other to the Spanish.
Well, I think we need to be clear that there were exceedingly cruel tribes of Indians, and especially all you have to do is look at the accounts of the martyrdoms of Jean de Brébeuf and Isaac Jogues and Lalemant and companions. And these people were vicious. But those same captivity stories persist in the settling of the American frontier. In fact, John Ford's The Searchers.
Yeah, right.
Is
a captivity
story.
Yeah,
it's based on one of those captivity stories.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But the
great Catholic filmmaker, by the way.
Right. But when you think about the viciousness of some of the Indian tribes, it really is in Canada, certainly, is some of the Indian tribes. Like the Mohawk are a real problem for everybody else.
They are.
And so As a matter of fact, the Mohar, yeah.
They're vicious people.
Yeah, in much the way that the Aztecs, who are not called Aztecs, are a problem for the Indians around them.
Sure.
Okay, so let's talk about the Catholic thing then. Okay, so now we have what we now identify as the United States is being settled by the English, whether it's in Delaware or in Virginia, Massachusetts, eventually Pennsylvania and New York and all that. So it's history determines there that now this is an English thing. But the loss of the Spanish Armada has something to do that too.
It does.
Doesn't it?
It's absolutely true. The eastern seaboard of the United States would have been settled by Spain had that battle gone a different way.
Right, had there not been a storm.
And in fact, yeah, they're defeated largely by weather.
Yeah, they were certainly not defeated by the English.
We could devote a show to this, but they make it to the other end of the channel largely intact.
Yeah.
It's coming back up and around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, well, yeah, but that's such as.
Let's do a show on the Spanish Armada.
Yeah. But that's what history is made of, is these
moments.
Right. Strange things. And so America, as we understand the United States, becomes an English-speaking, English
Protestant
place.
Anglican.
So when do
Anglican Calvinists.
When do Catholics come and how do we fit here?
Yeah. So just to that in a second, I recommend a book to our listeners by a superb American historian called David Hackett Fisher. He has a book called Paul Revere's Ride that is superb, and also Washington's Crossing. But his first big book was called Albion Seed, and he describes how the colonies, the Eastern Seaboard, were settled by four distinct ethnic groups of England. So the Puritans from East Anglia, the Celts down in the South, the people from Middle England who settle Delaware, and then eventually the Midwest Quakers among them, for example, and then the Southern England sort of gentlemen who settle Virginia. When people talk about the American experiment, for example, they're really ignoring what the settlement of England was, and it was these four different ethnic groups from England, settlement of the Americas from England. That word experiment is kind of silly when you actually look at the history, the anthropological history of it. Catholics do come in. They have their colony, Maryland. It's interesting. That's probably the colony where there's the most amount of religious tolerance practiced. Catholics in Maryland allowed Protestants to use their churches for their services. Whereas in Massachusetts,
yeah.
You would not see
no.
You wouldn't see a Christmas tree displayed during the time of Paul Revere.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of those Catholic trappings that has to be, you know,
right. Shoveled
out. Yeah.
Now, in part, in fairness, would it be a kind of accommodation that Catholics might have made because they knew they're surrounded by Protestants?
It may well be. Yeah. Yeah. I can't speak to for sure, but it certainly did happen. But I think Maryland is co-opted fairly quickly, much the way Catholics are co-opted by America until today.
And that is the story, isn't it? I mean, we are Protestantized Catholics
in
America.
Yes.
And there's, except for immediate immigrants.
Well, a Protestantized and a special kind of Protestantized, Americanized.
Okay. So that's what we want to talk a little bit about. I want to know more about that. That the Catholic interaction with America, I mean, Catholic people become accommodated to America in time, and it's fairly recently. America becomes accommodated to Catholics because we have the majority of our Supreme Court justices are Catholic, and we have politicians all over who are Catholic, and we seem to have fit in now.
Yeah, have we?
Okay, that's – we'll say something about that.
On the question of American justices, for example, or American politicians.
Yeah.
We've had one president who was a Catholic, who was at pains in the course of his election, particularly with the speech in Houston in September of 1960, to 150 or so Protestant ministers or leaders, who was at pains to say that his faith into which he was baptized is not going to influence his decisions as the chief executive of the United States. And then John Kerry, another example, running for president.
Catholic, right.
Yeah, making the same case. And then, of course, when we look at the Catholics on the court, and we should probably, you know, tally this up to be sure, but in the main, I would not say that they have voted in accord with the teachings of the church.
Yeah. Yes, I see what you're saying. So that is, they're Catholic, but they're highly accommodated to the American culture, so that a person like John Kennedy, and frankly, I mean, I think Catholics just wanted a Catholic president very badly. No one said, hey, wait a second, that's not Catholicism that you're
talking
about.
And it was very
about.
Common for Catholics in that time. They would have a picture of, you know, John the 23rd
my relatives,
JFK their houses. Yeah.
Right. Well, JFK, it was a very handsome fella too. So you know what? We got to take a break, Chris, but I want to talk more about this. Has America evangelized Catholics to make them into Americans, or have Catholics had some effect on bringing some Catholic sensibility to America? We'll do that after we take this break.
Yeah, the answer is yes and yes.
Oh, okay. Then we're going to need some elaboration right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Okay.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent just around the bend, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale. With hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code WINTER at checkout. With great new resources on Scripture, church history, the saints, Bible prophecy, and so much more. There's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code WINTER at checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
I met my husband in my first year of college. We both came from strong Catholic families and wanted lots of children. After 3 years of marriage and still not pregnant, we felt our dream of a big family slipping away. My sister encouraged us to visit our local Catholic store and get a novena to St. Gerard. When we arrived, we were unsure about our need, but the staff was kind and helpful. Wow, what an incredible Catholic store. They encouraged us to pray and trust in God's providence. One worker told us stories of other couples, just like us, who were desperate to start a family. 4 years and 2 children later, we have been back to that incredible Catholic store for baby, baptism, and toddler gifts. God bless the staff at that incredible Catholic store. An incredible Catholic store in your area can be found at incrediblecatholicstore.com. The Incredible Catholic Store, transforming the world one soul at a time.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check, our president, is our guest this hour for our very special Thanksgiving Day show. We're not taking calls. We're just having a conversation because we're pre-recording this so we can be home with our families for Thanksgiving. We've talked a bit about American religion and the kind of the American myth, and Thanksgiving is an important part of the American myth. We're certainly not saying, you tell me. It's not a terrible, awful myth. We're not saying America is a bad place or anything.
No,
like
national myths are important.
Yeah.
I would say the myths of a people, and there is such a thing as the American people. And again, I would refer people to David Hackett Fisher's book, Albion Seed, to begin to get a handle on what that means, American people. But I think these myths are important. I mean, you go to the Federal District, or what used to be called the Federal District, Washington, D.C., and you see all these monuments that were really built in the first part of the 20th century. And they're to tie our history. They are the temples of the national religion. Yeah. So you see the Lincoln Memorial, and it's meant to look like, I don't know, the Parthenon.
Right.
Right? And you see the Jefferson Memorial, and it's meant to look like the Pantheon. In Rome. Yeah. So these are the temples of our national myth to tie us to our Greek and Roman roots, which are there. I mean, the founders read Greek and Latin. They were inspired by
Cicero.
Absolutely, yeah. They were, by the, especially by men like Jefferson, especially by the Roman Republic before the Empire.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, these things are part of our national myth, and they're important. I'm for them.
But there's a some ways in which I will suggest to you, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the religious implication of being an American is, I wouldn't say idolatrous. I don't think it's idolatrous, but it is certainly associating too closely the institutions of the state with a kind of divine purpose. Would you agree with me on that?
There is that, Cy. And then, of course, there also is the, if you were to say that that the American religion has a credo, one element of that would be, individualism, or even sort of a hyper-individualism.
Yes.
And that, of course, comes out of the Enlightenment, right? This emphasis on the individual, the so-called rights of man that come out of the revolution in Paris. And then these things really do begin to find flower throughout the 19th century, so much so that by the end of the 19th century, is it in 1899 or thereabouts, Leo XIII is writing to James Cardinal Gibbons in Baltimore, warning of what has since become called the American heresy. Now, Gibbons, in fact, Jimmy Akin pointed this out on the air the other day, Leo does not use the expression heresy, but he does talk about some of these errors, among them the emphasis on the individual, that are incompatible with the Catholic faith. So Catholics have always kind of had an uneasy relationship, and sometimes a very difficult one in the middle of the 19th century, mm-hmm. during the period of the Know-Nothings. In the early part of the 19th century, you have the war with Mexico. You have the biggest defection in the history of the United States Army most people don't know about. But you have recent Irish immigrants and some Germans.
Yes, right.
The St. Patrick's Brigade, or the San Patricios, who defect from Winfield Scott's army because they see the treatment of the female native Catholic population in Mexico and desecration of Catholic churches, and then they fight on behalf of the Catholic Mexican army.
Right.
Now, they got a good offer, too. It's a complex story. But the treatment of Catholics in Winfield Scott's army was horrific. Yeah. And so Catholics throughout the 19th century always been sort of second-class citizens, and it is when they begin to accommodate themselves. I think World War II was a watershed moment here, because you have Catholics,
right.
and Protestants dying alongside of each other.
Yeah.
And you've got Catholics, Irish Catholics, who are great fighters, of course.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to say that?
I don't know, but we are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a football team called the Fighting Irish, right? So
right.
It's still okay to say that.
Right. And the greatest basketball team in the world is called the Celtics. So.
Right. Although it should be pronounced Celtics.
Come on, Chris.
So in any case, you have Catholics dying alongside their Protestant brethren. And I think that
right.
is, World War II is a galvanizing event.
May I mention one other galvanizing event? The rise of worldwide atheistic communism. That Catholics and Protestants could agree firmly that is not what we are, and that unit. But a person like Fulton Sheen was very acceptable to Protestants because he was so virulently an anti-communist.
And also, we see that manifested in the pro-life movement, which right. Begins very. You know, of course, the church has never changed her teaching on the immorality of taking an unborn life, but you do see there another galvanizing between evangelicals who are very American. I mean, and right. Mormons to a degree, although Mormonism allows abortion under certain circumstances. But you see that similar kind of galvanizing. But you're right. Reagan, for example, and Kennedy to a degree,
yeah.
But Reagan especially makes very good use of communism as a common enemy
right.
To galvanize Americans. And frankly, build the American empire, 600-ship navy.
Right. I might even suggest that in some ways communism took the place of Catholicism as the worldwide conspiracy that Americans were afraid of.
Right.
That in the 19th century, you had to be very careful about those Catholics because it's a worldwide anti-Masonic institution that really – all these Catholics at heart, they're faithful to the Pope. They're not faithful to the country. that goes away with the rise of worldwide communism. And the Second World War, as you said, is a galvanizing of all that because Catholics are replaced as the villain of the story.
Right. Now, of course, if you live in Poland or some other part of Eastern Europe, then you don't see World War II quite as the same victory that that Americans do because, of course, we gave Eastern Europe too.
But there's also this thing about some American institutions are very Catholic. For example, the United States Marine Corps has been traditionally very Catholic.
Catholicism is the most represented religion in the officer corps and the Marine Corps. At least that was true when I was in.
CIA is a profoundly Catholic organization. They, as a matter of fact, the CIA explicitly for decades recruited at Catholic colleges.
Right.
I don't know why they thought a Jesuit education would make people maybe willing to make the moral compromises.
Well, for all of the Jesuit troubles and confusion, they still are very educated men.
So here's the dilemma then. Is Catholicism lost if we become fully Americanized? Do we have to let go of what is distinctively Catholic?
I think to be completely American, to be a good American, of course, and so much is loaded in what the word good there means.
Yeah.
But to be
the ideal American.
To practice the American religion, you have to give up some of Catholicism. Now, there are of course, obviously, you can be a good citizen, a good patriot.
Yeah.
You could be a good German in the late 30s, early 40s, right, and still be a Catholic.
Yes.
Of course. Yeah.
Right. You can be a patriot.
Sure. I think, and the Catechism is very clear on this. I think one distinction Catholics need to have is an important distinction between patriotism and nationalism, right?
Okay.
Love of country, right? The patriot is a lover of his country, but it isn't a worship of country. It's not raising the country to that level of idolatry that you were talking about. And that's nationalism. And sometimes I wonder if we don't see that in certain practices that are so much a part of the
American
myth.
The national anthem being sung at sporting events.
That is a kind of a puzzle to me.
Yeah, that's very religious. That's we will now practice the American
now
religion.
Now we're singing the American hymn.
Like I don't feel offended by it myself, but I do think that's bringing the American religion in. Okay. This baseball game is somehow sanctified by the fact that it's an American undertaking and we sing the traditional American blessing before we play it.
And sanctified is a good word. And if you were to go to the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., who would you see buried there? Woodrow Wilson, for example. And you'll see a statue of Martin Luther King Jr. I think there's probably a bust of Kennedy in there as well. But it's really a war memorial. And if you go to St. Paul's in London, Christopher Wren's magnificent dome church there. Everyone buried there is a war hero from the British Empire, right?
Wow.
So you go to a Catholic church and who's buried there? Well, saints.
Yeah.
Saints
and bishops.
Yes, exactly. So members of the church. So when the Protestants do away with the Catholic Church at the beginning of the Reformation, right, or the Protestant Rebellion, which we're marking 500 years of, but when the English Protestants, and it's a little bit later under Henry, and then it, devolves, they still need something to maintain the social fabric. The Catholic Church in Europe was the thing, of course, it was the means of grace, it was the means of salvation, but it was also the thing that was the social fabric. So all of the holidays, were holy days, right?
Yes.
They were all the feast days. And of course, this goes back to Rome, too. So now our holy days are, events in the history of the American Empire. Are we running out of time?
That we're running out of time because there's so much more to talk about. But happy Thanksgiving.
And to you.
And it's good to give thanks.
I'm all for thanks.
Right.
Thanks is the most perfect human expression. It's what you're going to be giving in heaven.
Hey!
Constantly.
Well, that's good. Well, then Thanksgiving Day is a little bit of heaven.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
And so is being on the show with
depending on thanks, Chris. Depending on which family members show up, it can also be a little bit of the other place.
Amen. I don't know. No, mine's going to be. I know yours will be wonderful, too.
It will.
God bless you all.
All right. Jimmy Akin, next hour, Internet Open Forum, as we continue our very special Thanksgiving Day edition of Catholic Answers Live. We'll see you then.